Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The 2013 Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration takes place this evening at 7 o'clock at Congregation B'nai Emunah. This year's remembrance is in honor of the Kinder Transport. In 1938 and 39, just before World War II broke out, the British government took in approximately 10,000 Jewish children from Nazi Germany and its occupied territories and housed them for the duration of the war. My guests today were two of those children, Kurt and Margaret Goldberger. Kurt was a native of Vienna, Austria, who left for England after the Anschluss between Germany and Austria. Margaret was born in Berlin. The events of Kristallnacht convinced her parents to send her to England. Both lived in England during the war and then eventually immigrated to the United States, where they met and married. Both are active in the Kinder Transport Association and will be speaking at the commemoration, which will also feature local musicians playing music from the Oscar-winning documentary Into the Arms of Strangers, Stories of the Kinder Transport. Again, the Holocaust commemoration takes place this evening at 7 at Congregation B'nai Emunah, and Kurt and Margaret Goldberger are our guests today on Studio Tulsa. Margaret and Kurt Goldberger, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Our pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
This is a somewhat unknown story from the Second World War. In 1938 and 39, there was this effort it was going on throughout the West to get Jews out of Nazi Germany and Nazi-controlled areas, in the case of you, Kurt, Austria, part of the Anschluss. But I've never heard this story before about the Kinder Transport. This is on the very eve of war, basically children immigrating to the West. Tell us how this happened. What was the circumstances behind it?
Well, people have probably heard of the Night of Broken Glass.
Yes,
which
Kristallnacht.
Which is known as Kristallnacht, right? The British, after that happened, realized how terrible it was for Jews to live in Germany and in Austria. And there was a debate in Parliament, which took place over several days. And in the end, they decided that they would let children under the age of 17 to come to England as long as they wouldn't be able to work because they didn't want jobs to be taken away from the British, which at the time also had a large unemployment rate. So within a few days after Kristallnacht, this debate began. And by the 21st of November, they passed this rule that an unspecified number of children could come to England. By December 1st, the first so-called Kindertransport, children's transport, was arranged out of Berlin. And that's how it began. In the period of approximately 9 months, almost 10,000 children were rescued that way and came to England.
What a tremendous decision both of your families had to make. Can you give us a sense, and especially as a child growing up in this situation where anti-Semitism was present probably from birth, this was the normal, wasn't it?
Well, at that point, when the Nazis came to power, I was about 6-7 years old. So I understood why
so
my parents wanted to send me to safety, because I saw what was going on pretty much, not everything, but quite a lot. And so it was a sacrifice that the parents made, saying, you know, even if we ourselves cannot immigrate because so many countries were not accepting refugees, let's send the children to safety. And that's, you know, how they made that painful decision. It wasn't always an easy thing for parents to do that.
Hardest decision I can even imagine. And Kurt, was it the same for you?
Well, pretty much, of course, in Austria, it started later. Hitler
yes.
marched into Austria in March of 1938, and most of the Jewish people at this point realized they'll have to find some way to safety. Although most of the Austrian Jews, particularly the men, served in the Austrian army during World War I, but it didn't make any difference to Hitler's regime to discriminate against them as well as anybody else. So they were looking, most of them, for some place to be rescued, somewhere, somehow. As I said, we were just fortunate, both Margaret and I, that we were selected for the Kindertransport. Who knows what might have happened to us?
Yeah, in Vienna, certainly there was anti-Semitism.
Absolutely.
I mean, the accounts are rife from even the late 1800s.
When Hitler marched into Austria, his army marched into Austria in 1938, He was welcomed with open arms, and the average population was really anti-Semitic, including the mayor in the 20s of Vienna, Dr. Karl Lueger, was an open anti-Semite.
Mm-hmm.
And although the Austrians, the Jews in Austria, contributed to the success of the Austrian government,
yeah,
they were instrumental in fashion, in music, and played a great role in many other cultural activities.
Scientific community, the arts community.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was the Austrian Jewish community. And I think that engendered a lot of jealousy and that sort of fueled that. But was there when the Anschluss took place, was there an overnight change in Vienna? Or
practically.
Yeah.
For instance, I was in Realschule, which is a high school. I was 13 years old. They closed the schools immediately and separated the Jewish children from the Aryan children. That was immediate. It only took a week. When we got back to school, there were no more joint classes between non-Jews and Jews. And within a few days, every bench in the park was marked, no Jews allowed to sit there, or public places we weren't allowed to go to. So the necessity to find an outlet to get out of there was very important to most people. Some thought it wasn't going to happen to them, but unfortunately, it eventually did.
Of course, this is one of the great ironies of the Holocaust, as these sort of anti-Jewish laws are propagated. A lot of Jewish families said, well, this is as bad as it's going to get. Can you talk about your own family's reactions? Obviously, they thought it was going to get worse to give up a beloved child.
Well, up to the event of Kristallnacht, my father and mother felt, my father had a business. It was a store, and he also was a licensed plumber and electrician. So he still had work. He still, you know, had the store and so on. And up to that point, people still felt, and I think my parents felt, it can't get much worse than it's been so far with all the new rules, no, all the new laws. But after that event, then people like my parents said, we have to try and get out of here. But, you know, for many people, leaving was very difficult because many, many of the countries closed their borders to refugees. America had a strict quota system, and, you know, you couldn't just simply say, well, tomorrow I'm going to immigrate. There was no way of doing that. You had to get sponsorship in the form of an affidavit. You had to get the permission from the American consulate in Berlin, for instance.
Privilege really made a big difference in being able to get out, didn't it?
Well, it was very difficult. It was very difficult.
Very difficult for anybody, but privilege certainly helped.
Well, sometimes.
Yeah.
And Einstein got out easily, okay? But we weren't all Einsteins, so, you know, it's one of those things, right?
Unfortunately, not every country looked at the same way as Great Britain. For instance, in the United States, into American Congress, Senator Wagner of New York and Congresswoman Rogers of Massachusetts introduced a bill into Congress to admit 20,000 unaccompanied children to the United States. This bill never got out of committee. And finally they said, it is in our tradition that we don't separate children from their parents.
Mm.
And I think this is a really black mark on the United States. Senate and poor House, they were good people, but unfortunately the majority of them one that's sympathetic to Jewish causes.
We forget our own anti-Semitism, which was certainly prevalent in the 1930s as well.
You had the Bund, you had the Ku Klux Klan, etc.
Yeah.
And the State Department was not sympathetic at all.
Yeah. So how did this take place? Was there an announcement in the papers? Or how did this come about? And once you were selected, your parents...
Well, how we were selected, I do not know. But I do know that in the Jewish community, you know, there were some Jewish newspapers still and so forth. You did hear about these transports that were being organized. What they did to begin with in Berlin, there was a Jewish orphanage. Doesn't mean that all the children were orphans, but some of them, the families had been able to get out without the children. Some of them had already been deported to Poland. Because, you know, they had their families had originated in Poland. So many of these children, and I knew some of those children who were in that Berlin orphanage, they were the first ones to be taken to England. You know, the first transport began on December 1st, And those were the ones that first came to England. The problem was, of course, that they were not immediately placed in families because you couldn't get that organized fast enough. So the first bunch primarily went to a summer holiday camp in December, which was unheated and not totally comfortable. But, you know, the photographs of the children sitting in their coats in this big camp dining hall. And, you know, they were safe, and it was a temporary placement for them until families could be found or hostels could be opened. And that was the beginning of it, and soon more hostels and more families.
Of course, we don't know why, even Margaret or I don't know why we were selected. We were the lucky ones. Of course, I'm sure there must have been other parents who registered their kids for this who did not get onto the... And why we were selected, that's a process that I don't think anybody knows.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I didn't leave until June of 1939, and Kurt left in July of 1939.
Wow.
So we were not amongst
the
first group.
2 months before the opening of hostilities.
That when the day I left Vienna, I felt was a wish of the American public, because I left Vienna on July 4th. 1939, not realizing that this is the national holiday in the United States.
Right. And so you came to Britain. Tough decision for your parents to sign you up for this program. Tough decision for you, even as children, you know, to leave your parents to go off into the unknown.
My parents, when my mother got her quota number from the American consulate, she didn't tell me that that number wouldn't come up for 2.5 years. Okay. So my mother said to me, we're going to see you soon again. This will be an adventure. You've taken some English lessons. You'll be okay. And as soon as we get to the United States, we'll send for you and, you know, have an interesting time. And so I took it as that. If they had told me that it would be 7 years till I saw my mother again and never did see my father again for a different reason, you know, it would have been a different story. And then you take the story of the little children who absolutely did not understand why their parents were sending them away, why suddenly some strange older girl would be in charge of them until they got to England. And these little kids were crying, you know, 2, 3, 4 years old. They have no idea what's going on. But I was old enough to know.
Yeah.
My story is a bit unique. What happened, England made it possible for adults to come to England as domestic servants. Because the British didn't want to do this menial job, so they did it. So my mother applied to get to England as a domestic servant and got the permission to go with her sister. My mother as a cook, her sister as a chambermaid. And originally they had the laws were there that I could go with them. However, they were changed in the meantime. My mother was told that I can't go with her, and she said, I'm not going by myself. And my father, in his wisdom, insisted that she goes and said, you go and see what you can do to bring us out. And after a while, through the family that she worked for, they heard about the Kinder transport. And eventually, when I came to England, I was reunited with my mother. But after 3 days staying with my mother, they sent me to a different place because domestic servants have no children. And I lived in a hostel for boys. For 20 boys, and subsequently was my mother and I, my father came to the United States later on.
Give us a sense of how the war years unfolded for you, because I could see having such conflicted feelings because, you know, families and loved ones are still in Germany. You're in a country that, yes, they've taken you in, but there were some of the same forces at play in England
There were some strange incidents, you know, occasionally, especially when school children were evacuated to the country. Those people in these little farm communities, they didn't know who we were. To them, we were Germans, okay? We could have been German spies, even though we were only 10, 12, 13 years old or something. So that was a little bit strange for them.
Now, were both of you part of the youth to the country movement that was a part of England during
evacuation.
The war? Yeah, the evacuation.
Yes.
So, pardon me?
I was evacuated also.
Uh-huh. And where did, so where was your wartime years spent?
Well, just before the war broke out, the day before, we were all issued, the English children as well, all issued gas masks.
Yes.
Which we had hung
the little box, our necks, the little
right?
box, that's
and
right.
We practiced them, yeah. You know, we practiced to put them on and all that. And then on the Saturday before the Germans invaded Poland and before the British declared a war, we were sent by train to this little village called Cockley Clay. No one ever heard of it. Owned by one family, Sir Samuel and Lady Roberts. And we stayed actually in their mansion, in a separate wing of the mansion with oodles of servants, but they weren't there to serve us. They were there to serve the family, a la Downton Abbey.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, where we stayed for just 2 years, when those of us who became 15 in 1941 were told, that's the end of your schooling. You're now going to go back to London in another hostel, and you're going to go to work. Unskilled, knowing the language, okay, we did fine with that, but no skill or anything. So most of us were assigned to factories, or, you know, learning maybe how to do dressmaking or something like that. But it was sort of a strange shock to us to work and not really know any kind of skill or anything like that.
Yeah. Same for you, Kurt?
Similar, of course. When I was evacuated, I eventually was released with my mother to live with my mother and went to work because my mother couldn't support me. And I just had to go to work at this point and worked there until 1944 when we got our papers to come to the United States. During the war, we got passage on a freighter. My mother and I, 10 people on that freighter in a convoy of about 80 ships zigzagging across the Atlantic until we finally arrived. We didn't know where. It happened to have been New York without any problems on the way. And then eventually was reunited with my father, who had gone to Des Moines, Iowa, when the committee sent him there. And we were finally united, and my mother and I and the family lived together.
That's a very rare and happy story from this
particular
time.
That's right, because unfortunately most parents in the Kindertransport never saw their parents again.
Yeah.
About 75% of the children never did see their parents.
You asked for communications after the war began. I had an uncle who lived in Holland, mm-hmm. my mother's brother, who had immigrated there. And before Holland was occupied, I would send him letters, which he would then forward to Berlin and vice versa. So I did hear from my parents until the occupation of Holland, which was around 1940. After that, the Red Cross had a system whereby you could put 25 words on a postcard, and, you know, either from Germany or from England. But if the Germans didn't like something that was said on the postcard, they would black it out. So, you know, they'd get like half a message or something like that.
Yeah.
It worked for a little while, and then just, you know, it was dropped altogether. So for the longest part, until my parents finally did get out in 1941, as promised by the American consulate, 2.5 years, your quota number. For the longest time, I didn't know where my parents were. My friends didn't know, you know, what was happening to their parents, you know, the girls that I had met in the hostel. And the majority of them never, ever saw or heard of their parents again. So, you know, it was one of those things. I was lucky that my parents did eventually get out.
Well, when we hear that you were both on the Kindertransport and you both went to England, we would have to assume that you met there, but in fact, you'd never met there. You met in the United States.
That's correct.
Yeah,
there was a club in New York of young Jewish men and women, single, most of them, which met socially and did things together. And out of this club, there must have been 60 or 70 marriages. And we were one of them, and we've been married now for 64 years.
Yeah, well, congratulations
Thank
on
you.
That. And, you know, you have one of the more positive stories of this era from folks who lived in Germany at the time of the Nazi rise. I mean, both of your immediate families were able to get out. But I can imagine your extended families, there's huge gaps.
Yeah, let me tell you about that. Yeah.
And I think that psychological, there's a psychological weight of that, isn't there?
I had an aunt and uncle who lived in a small town in Germany, and they were quite religious observant. And they had four children, and the three older ones, the oldest girl was my age at the time, 12, something like that. And the three older ones were certainly eligible to go on a kinder transport. Everybody in the family urged them to sign their children up. And they were afraid that the children would not come to a religious family or couldn't keep kosher, and they said, we'd rather stay together. As a result, in 1942, the two adults, mother and father, were arrested, sent to Auschwitz, and the four children, we never heard where they ended up or what happened to them. Altogether, 23 of my close relatives, aunts, uncles, and cousins, were killed in the Holocaust.
That uncle in Holland, did he survive?
Yes, he did.
He did, good.
He and his wife and his son worked with the Dutch underground. Especially the wife and the son looked very, very blonde and very Aryan, okay? And they carried messages back and forth within the underground movement. So my girl cousin, Eleanor, looked very, very what you call Semitic. And she was hidden by a farm family in the Dutch countryside. And at daytime, they kept her under floorboards so she wouldn't be seen by anyone. And at night, they let her be out because they did not expect nighttime visitors. But all four of them survived, and yeah. Eleanor eventually wound up becoming an educator, moving to Israel and working in conjunction with the education ministry in Israel.
You know, that's a lucky story, but right. Think about it. 5 years of never seeing, having the sun, you know,
not
sitting in the sun.
On you. Right.
Yeah, no, that's
right.
Nice. Right. Kurt, what about your extended family?
Well, fortunately, my immediate family all got out for some strange reason and wind up all over the world. They wind up in Israel, at Palestine at the time, in Shanghai, in the United States, and somewhere else, but in other words, but they survived at least. Well, it was the coincidence. I mean, there was no reason. My grandmother still died of a natural cause after both her sons had left for the United States. And I said, in that respect, I was fortunate that the family eventually reunited, and we lived a pretty useful life, I think, you know, all of us. And what I'm always grateful for, many of us feel we want to pay back that we were saved. And both Margaret and I are very active, particularly in the Jewish community, to talk about the problems of children today. And our organization, we have an organization called the Kindertransport Association of the United States, and I was the president for 14 years. And we are committed to tell the story of the Kindertransport and to support organizations which help children in need today, regardless of their background.
Now, I would think, have you been back to England to, were there people who remember, you know, your time in their country and, you know, people that you have really fortunate experiences with?
Altogether, the English public doesn't know that much about the Kindertransports. However, when we lived in that little village, Cockley Clay, Sir Samuel and Lady Roberts' grandson still owns 5,000 acres there, okay, and still owns that big old house, except it needs a lot of repair. They don't have the number of servants that they used to have. In fact, very, very part-time people.
The house system pretty much died with World War II. Yeah, it did.
But he invited us. We were in England in 1999 for a reunion of Kindertransport people, the 60-year reunion, right? And he invited us to come out to Cockley Clay. And he said, I think we have 12 bedrooms. He wasn't even sure, you know. But anyway, he accommodated all of us who came back, a bunch of us, including husbands or wives, respectively. You know, only husbands, because we were all girls.
Yeah.
Even our grandson came along, you know. And he was sort of funny because Sir Samuel Roberts took him around, you know, on his tractor or something. That was kind of cute. And then, you know, English children, as part of the upper classes, are sent to boarding school. And our grandson Brian said, I don't understand this. He said, they have all this room here. Why do they send him away to school? So very, very different, you know, than what he had seen in America. So,
yeah. And for you, Kurt, did you visit the places that you...
Yes, of course. We were together in England in 1999. It was the 60th reunion of the Kindertransport Association. And we had a great experience. But I did not go back, actually, to the places I used to be at. because I really have no connection at this point anymore. I mean, if we were going back to Austria, I could tell a story, but this is for another time.
Yeah. If I can ask you one last question, that is the decision to start talking about this story. I know I'm a child of World War II parents, and I'm sure it's the same in immigrant families as well as those. After the war, there was this sort of sense, this was a horrible incident. Let's move on with our lives and forget about it. And I imagine that was the same in your family as you were starting, or
it
not?
Was not talking so much about our family or my family. Actually, many of the Holocaust survivors, the people who went through the camps and all the horrors of that, didn't want to talk about it very much for years and years. And in our case, the Kindertransport story sort of, you know, well, that was then, and we didn't talk about that either until this lady in England, one of the children then, decided to have this first conference in 1989. And then we started to talk about it, and everybody started, you know, who had been associated with it. And today, for instance, in our association, we have a speakers bureau of which I am the chairman. And we get a lot of requests to have, you know, people come and speak and talk about our experiences. So, you know, that has become better known amongst the general public.
I think it's an important story because so often when we hear about these stories of resistance and saviorship, we tend to think of it as individual families, individual people. Here was a government who really did take a big effort to make, you know, make a difference for whatever it could. And so I think it's really important that that story gets out there. Is that sort of a sense of you?
Yeah, it only became important, as Margaret said, when after the called it first reunion, the 50th remembrance of the Kindertransport. Prior to that, I knew some people who I knew they were in England or during the war, but never talked why they were in England and what happened to them. And it wasn't until we had a reunion here in the United States that I saw people there. I said, wait a minute, what are you doing here? And they said the same thing as you are. I was on the Kindertransport. I said, oh my goodness. And we became good friends subsequently.
Well, certainly these incidents still occur around the world, and whether it's in Darfur or wherever, I think knowing about the story says, well, yes, there is precedence for, you know, saving people.
That's right.
Is that a motivation for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's why we have our charitable fund. I'm not doing fundraising here. But we have a charitable fund that people will contribute to. And then regardless of where people are, children are in need, what their race is, what their background is, their religion is, and so on, we give to those causes quite substantial amounts every year through our charitable fund. So, you know, there's quite a lot of help being given to children in need, and we think that's very, very important.
Well, we look forward to hearing your story at the Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration.
Today.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Okay, our pleasure.
Margaret and Kurt Goldberger were two of the 10,000 Jewish children known as the Kindertransport, which took place in 1938 and 1939. They'll be the guest of honor at the 2013 Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration, which takes place this evening at 7 o'clock at Congregation B'nai Emuna. And that, of course, is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Rich Fisher. Thank you.